This is the third day of this January 2010 Rohatzu Sashin, and we'll resume reading from the chronological biography of Zen Master Hakuin, which was written by his Dharma successor, Tore Enji. And this is from a book called Hakuin's Precious Mirror Cave, a Zen Miscellany. It's edited and translated by Norman Waddell. We left off yesterday with our hero in some trouble, although he didn't know it. He did know it, because he had run into this monster, Shouju, after having had a deep enlightenment, as according to the records anyway. He got into this phase of swaggering around and loud and bumptious. Roshi Kaplow once said that the Japanese sometimes call that post-satori state. It leaves someone like fresh bread, kind of airy, puffed up, redolent. And then his wisdom mind drew him to this hermit, this master living in a hermitage, Shouju, who rained down abuse on him for the deficiencies in his realization. He boxed him in with a few koans and other questions that stymied him. And we left off Shouju repeatedly just laughing and jeering at him, "You cave-dwelling Zen corpse." And the last thing we read was when he attempted to speak, that is, Hakuin, Shouju would silence him with deafening shouts. The master thought to himself, "The old man treats me so shabbily because he doesn't know what a splendid enlightenment I've had. I'll need to muster all my strength and confront him in a struggle to the death." It may very well have been a splendid enlightenment, but if Hakuin's thinking of it as a splendid enlightenment, then there's something wrong. So, "I'll need to muster all my strength and confront him in a struggle to death." The next time he entered Shouju's room and began his interview, Shouju again scolded him severely, but the master stuck defiantly to his position. Shouju grabbed him by the collar and delivered a score of blows with his fist, knocking the master down. He rolled off the veranda onto the ground and lay there unconscious. When he came to, he saw Shouju glaring down at him, roaring with laughter. His body pouring sweat, he suddenly realized how mistaken he had been. He clambered quickly back onto the veranda and prostrated himself before Shouju. "You cave-dwelling Zen corpse," Shouju shouted at him. The master now threw himself into the koan of Nanchuan's death with even greater determination. Once he thought he had penetrated it and went to Shouju's chambers to present his understanding. But Shouju refused to accept it. He chased him out with more abuse. "Cave-dwelling Zen corpse." For days, the master labored over the koan. See, this is where we see what distinguishes someone of really superior aspiration, who even after having a deep enlightenment, not just some little pipsqueak seeing through his first koan, but had a deep enlightenment, And still now, with the help of Shoju, now he was back at laboring to go further, to go deeper. He went to the village on a begging round, that's Takahatsu, and took up a position beside the entrance to a house. An old woman came out and told him to leave, but the master remained where he was with a stupid look on his face. Angered, the old woman grabbed a bamboo broom. "Didn't you hear me?" she said, brandishing it over her head. "I told you to go somewhere else." She gave him a hard swat with a broom. At that instant, the meaning of the ancient Zen masters was his. Dahui's verse about the round, round lotus leaf, Sushan's memorial tower, Nanshuan's death, and all the other profound, hard-to-penetrate principles he had struggled over, that until now he had been unable to make any dent in whatever, they were all at once clear and distinct before his eyes. He hurried back to the hermitage in an ecstasy of joy. Before he was through the gate, don't worry, we're all right here. Before he was through the gate, Shoju saw from the look on his face what had happened and welcomed him with delight. "You have come through," he said. Now he's still just 23 years old. The biographer tells us that Hakumen told Shoju of his wish to receive the full precepts. This is another good sign. When it may have been that after his first enlightenment, when he was so full of himself, he felt that there was nothing he needed of the precepts, that they were all empty. And nothing for him to concern himself with. But now he wanted to receive the full precepts. And it says, Shoju explained and then imparted to him the secrets of the formless mind precepts. Let's see if we can figure out, get a footnote on that. I haven't heard of that by that name. There's nothing particularly helpful in the footnote. The master served at Shoju's side for over 8 months, receiving his instruction constantly day and night, until at last he penetrated the profound core of Shoju's Zen. And then finally, when he was leaving with a couple of other monks, and with Shoju, walked him for quite some distance, walked him to the beginning of his journey, accompanied him. But I guess Hakuen got kind of misplaced by Shoju in the small knot of monks, and so Shoju at one point said, "Where is Hakuen?" The master stepped forward. Shoju took his hand, gripping it tightly. "I want you to devote all your effort to turning out one or two real monks. Don't try for a large number. If you do, it will be hard to produce a superior student. If you can manage to bring up one or two authentic seedlings, the ancient Zen winds will rise once again." This is almost word for word what his previous teacher had advised him when they parted. We have to always wonder how much of this is hakuins. Of course, the stuff that the personal internal thoughts and so forth are his. They have to be. And the parts where he's alone, such as when he had his was with the old woman and she swatted him with the broom. That account didn't come from the old woman, probably. And then you wonder about even this, since it's so much the same as what his previous teacher had advised him. But it doesn't matter, does it? Because getting this advice, hearing this, even from Hakuin, even if it weren't these two teachers, it's good enough for me. So, if you manage to bring up one or two authentic seedlings, the ancient Zen winds will rise once again. After a long silence, Shoju at last released the master's hand and he told another monk there, stay with Hakuin. He will make sure that your Dharma eye opens. The master listened intently to Shoju's instructions, tears forming in his eyes. He thanked him and then departed. And then it says, as the final sentence, he spent the winter retreat at Shoenji. That was his home temple. Age 24, he went to a certain province to hear lectures on the Diamond Sutra. And then things turned a little sour again. This is what we read here from his biographer, who, of course, must have heard it from Hakuin. In examining his everyday behavior, the master could see an inconsistency between the active and meditative aspects of his life. When active, he was never able to experience a true sense of freedom. As far as the realization he had attained was concerned, and his grasp of the words of the ancients, he was sure both were exceedingly sharp and clear. To his regret, however, he realized that in the daily affairs of life, he was not complete master of his mind and body. When working on a koan during zazen, his mind would be calm and focused, yet this same composure was lacking when he returned to the busy world of everyday life. This, of course, is the ultimate challenge. It's not awakening, it's post-awakening. It's integrating what one has realized into one's everyday life. And that is where we find we have unending work to do. I can still hear Roshi Kaplow in workshops outlining this principle to wide-eyed workshop participants and saying, you've seen, this is what he would say, I've got it memorized, you've seen into the truth. You know how to act, how to respond. And yet you're still pushed this way and that way by obstructive old karma that grips you. There's a saying in Zen, the wind ceases, but the waves still surge. People who haven't seen into their true nature may think that they would be discouraged. And I suppose if you have a very, very tenuous glimpse into your true, if you had only a tenuous glimpse into your true nature, it could be discouraging at times. to see the work that remains to be done. But after a deeper awakening, it serves as a spur, because you know what the way things are. And the way things are is that each one of us is fundamentally enlightened in our true nature. So it's a matter of just setting on to work and persevering and cleaning up the old karma. So certainly for Hakuin, after his two deep enlightenment experiences, he's ready to go back into the arena. But first, more here from the biographer, from Hakuin through the biographer. Although he formulated ideas and principles with a high-minded determination and resolve, when he set about trying to apply those ideas, the influence of his former delusive mental habits would invariably intrude and prevail over the principles he had determined upon. He saw in observing the workings of his mind that in favorable circumstances, feelings of attachment would appear in great number, while in unfavorable circumstances, feelings of aversion would invariably arise. Just to pause here, these are the two poles of difficulty that we face as human beings, the dyad between what we like and what we dislike, our desires and our aversions. This is right at the center of the Buddha's teaching when he said, "I teach but two things, suffering and the end of suffering." Well, this is a very succinct way of framing what we're up against in this suffering that is common to the human condition, caught between our desires, what we want, and what we don't want, what we like, what we dislike. This is what runs through the affirming faith in mind that we chant every day. This lays it out in very, very plain terms. But he goes on, under his very gaze, joy and anger, love and hate, worries and anxieties, compassion and fear would come and go, appearing and reappearing. He was unable to correct this tendency through ordinary intellectual means and lacked the power to transform external conditions through the vital Zen function of going beyond. Gatte, gatte, paragatte. Notice he says he was unable to correct this tendency through ordinary intellectual means. It's not enough to just reason with yourself. Okay, now hold on. There's no self here, and there's no other. What's the problem? Get a grip. Why do you keep losing your temper? Why do you do this? Why do you do that? What's going on here? This shouldn't bother you. Could it be, he reflected, that the way of Kensho is just another of those words devoid of truth and substance? When the Zen patriarchs of old achieved their great transformation, weren't they like the dragon who obtains lasting and unrestricted freedom the instant he reaches a drop of water? You can hear Hakuin's writing here, as we know from other sources, other texts of Hakuin's teachings, his writing is just the most robust, colorful, richly expressed kind of writing. It's just an absolute marvel to read his writing, and we are, I think, right now reading his writing. The difference between the teachings of greater and lesser vehicles, that's the Mahayana and the Hinayana, is a difference in the depth of the teachings that students are given to dispel their illusions. Shravakas reach a state of non-defilement by meditating on the fourfold truth. Now, these first words, Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas, these are they're four realms of four realms of enlightened existence, as outlined. They're the six realms of unenlightened existence, which we've often talked about in Taisho. And then beyond that, after enlightenment, there are these four levels. The first is Shravaka, which means one I can never remember them. One is self-enlightened. I think that's a Pratika Buddha, and the Shravaka is something else. But they're both short of the level of Bodhisattva and Buddha. So Shravakas reach a state of non-defilement by meditating on the fourfold truth. Pratyeka Buddhas attain nirvana by contemplating and realizing the 12-fold chain of dependent co-origination, also known as the law of dependent co-arising. Bodhisattvas develop extraordinary powers by realizing the true emptiness of all things. Zen monks turn directly within themselves to eliminate attachments to Buddha wisdom above, even as they dispel the influence of delusory mental habits below. See, he's saying they turn to eliminate attachments to Buddha wisdom. Yes, even the most exalted maxims of truth and wisdom, the highest principles, can become attachments. This is the basic teaching of Zen, is we can become attached to anything. And this is what is so uncompromising about the Zen school, is demands that we let go of our clinging to even the most lofty of thoughts and principles and images. So they rid themselves of those attachments to Buddha wisdom, even as they dispel the influence of delusory mental habits below. I feel like a physician who possesses a wonderful knowledge of medicine, but who has no effective means of curing an actual illness. I already know the remedy for discrimination. I have grasped the secrets our school has for going beyond. Yet here I am, still suffering from illness myself. How can I possibly hope to cure other sentient beings of their afflictions? So, a different person with these two enlightenment experiences under his or her belt, might not have such concerns. They might be complacent and happy to just move through the world, savoring her or his enlightenment. But Hakuin is a rare individual here. He goes on, there is no doubt where the cause of my problem lies. Having achieved Kensho, I have penetrated the nature of discrimination. But because my ties to life are still not completely severed, and because the power I might derive from samadhi is also not yet mature, I still have trouble integrating the Dharma truth I have grasped into my daily life. Just this one phrase, I have penetrated the nature of discrimination. He has seen that all discriminations are empty. They have no substance. They have no roots to them. High and low, good and bad, enlightenment and unenlightenment, empty discriminations. Past, future, present, man, woman, pure, impure, empty, all of these dualisms. But it's not enough. The master now took the whip in hand, and with his jaw set firmly and eyes open wide, notice that, eyes open wide, he once again, quote, spurred the dead ox forward. While engaged in the affairs of every day, he pursued practice within activity. While doing zazen, he immersed himself in the tranquility of samadhi. Sleeping and eating were virtually forgotten. This phrase, spurred the dead ox forward, clearly doesn't refer to any kind of lack of spirit in him, but rather the dead part would refer to the fact that he has pretty much lost his self. He's beyond the self, at least in his understanding, if not his actions. Age 25, when spring came, he returned to Shōinji. He attended lectures on the Blue Cliff Record. The masters, I'm skipping a section here, interesting section where he goes out and drinks sake with some other monks and Sōkaku, who we touched on yesterday, the monk who led him to Shōju. But the master's lack of freedom in his everyday activity still showed no sign of improvement. Weakened by long years of arduous training, he was set upon by the demons of sickness. The heat in his heart began to mount upward into the area of his neck and head, parching and drying out his lungs. He consulted physicians, but they were unable to help him. 12 morbid symptoms appeared. I'm going to run through these just for fun. who said that? One, fire-like burning in the head. Two, loins and legs cold as ice. Three, eyes constantly watering. Four, ringing in the ears. Five, instinctive shrinking from sunlight. Six, irrepressible sadness in darkness or shade. Seven, thinking an intolerable burden. Eight, recurrent bad dreams sapping the strength. 9. Emission of semen during sleep. 10. Restlessness and nervousness during waking hours. 11. Difficulty digesting food. 12. Cold chills unrelieved by heavy clothing. He became just like a confirmed invalid, losing all interest in the concerns of the world and his fellow men. But he decided that instead of just sitting back and letting himself rot away, he might as well try to find a physician who could cure him. He set out from Shōinji, traveling westward. And then he came upon a hermit whose name was Hakuyu. Now there are scholars who insist that Hakuyu was also really Hakuin. But this is a section I'm going to skip because it's just so much based on the body and physical things, and I'll leave it to others to look it up in this book if they want to. But it's, I've never been able to relate to it much. Some kind of physical practices that are very strange. Finally, he parted from the hermit Hakuyu and returned to his home temple, Shōinji. There he devoted himself single-mindedly to cultivating the meditation techniques he had learned. But before long, the heat in his heart was mounting upward into the region of his neck and head. It continued to grow in intensity until it was almost unbearable. He found he could obtain some relief by discontinuing the meditation and doing nothing at all. But as soon as he resumed the practice and made the slightest exertion to control his mind, the heat would start to rise. Recalling having heard that when a morbid upward flow of primal ki energy such as this continued unchecked, it inevitably ended in death, he decided to put it to the test. He went through his belongings, assembling notes and manuscripts he had accumulated during his years of koan study, and committed them to the fire. He made sure he had enough money for his funeral expenses, then he sat down and began meditating, detached and aloof, determined to sit his way through to the end. Soon, ki energy moving against the natural flow began rising into the area of his upper chest. It gradually increased in intensity, pulsating up through his throat and into his jaw. As it continued moving upward, he felt a throbbing inside his nose and reaching into his eyes. A pair of ball-shaped objects suddenly seemed to pop out from his eye sockets. Catching at them, he felt an intense stabbing pain in his brain. He held on desperately to the two objects, but they broke free, soaring quickly upward like a pair of skylarks and disappearing into the sky. Immediately his heart felt lighter. His sharpness and alertness returned. He had succeeded at last in severing himself from the illness that had been oppressing him for so many years. And then it says he devoted the summer months to Zazen. What a surprise. And practiced with other monks. And then he went to another temple and listened to lectures on the record of Linchi, Rinzai. Age 26, spring. He read a passage in a text it said, since the time of the first Buddha, those wise men and eminent priests who lacked the Bodhi mind have all fallen into the realm of demons. The words struck terror into the master's heart. He was covered with goose flesh, and the hair rose up all over his body. So he's not done yet. Age Age 27, the master used his free hours during the day to, quote, illuminate his mind with the teachings of the ancients. At night, when he was not busy preparing food or medicine for his teacher, he devoted himself to Zazen. One day during his reading, he happened upon a verse by Master Shu Dong. And this is the verse. When I saw you off, there was a tall bamboo at the gate. Its leaves, moving in the pure breeze, joined me in waving farewell. He felt like someone moving along a dark night trail who had suddenly obtained a bright lamp. The meaning of the old saying about the ancients achieving a samadhi of words and letters when they reached this stage in their training was now perfectly clear to him. He was on his way somewhere else, and as he was accosted by a young boy selling candy. "Please buy some of these," the boy said. "Buy them, whether you want them or not." And the master reflected with a sigh, "How truly he speaks. If someone has truly dedicated his life to the practice of the way, he must continue forward no matter what, whether he sees results or not, until he reaches his ultimate goal." He went to another teacher, a senior monk, who left him uninspired. It just goes on recounting his travels here and there, meeting various people. At one point, he encountered a rain-swollen mountain torrent that had overflowed its banks, inundating the road. He hitched up his robe and began wading across. After slogging several hundred feet, he came to a broad expanse of water. At that instant, he suddenly penetrated into the infinite vastness of Da Hui's verse. Beside himself with joy, he lost his footing and toppled over into the water. Some travelers came along and tried to help him up, but when he just lay back in the mud, roaring with laughter, they backed away from him, thinking he had taken leave of his senses. Right, let's stop now and recite the four vows.